Welcome to the Family Express podcast, where our destination is resilient and connected families. Come aboard with your hosts, marriage and family therapists, Catherine DeBruin and Rhonda Evans, to explore the world of emotionally focused family therapy, a model developed by Sue Johnson and colleagues. Together with our guest speakers, our travels will map the EFFT landscape, highlighting lessons learned, shared fears, and the passion and curiosity that bonds our community.
Welcome back to the Family Express with Catherine and Rhonda. We have a new kind of episode in store for our listeners, don't we, Catherine?
I'm looking forward to this, Rhonda. As I've been meeting with families recently, and especially when I'm meeting for the parental session, I'm often looking back into the developmental history and trying to get a sense of what the emotional climate has been for the family so that I can understand the current symptomology in the context of how the family has developed. And so I've learned over time to ask the parents like all these questions, starting with conception and pregnancy, or you know, questions about how the family became a family. What I've been doing recently is, as I'm collecting all this developmental history, like content, so to speak, I'm really trying to pay attention to what was the family atmosphere like at the time? What challenges did this family run into? What kind of emotion would that have brought up? And how was that handled relationally so that I can get a better idea of how the distress could have built itself through the system to give rise to the current symptomology? So it's just something that I'm challenging myself with, is trying to do an emotional and relational attachment history review.
I love that. I love that. So you're working with the parents, and then you're getting this emotional relational history, like the contextual emotional relational history. You're not like milestones. When did the kid walk? It's, you're talking about what was the emotional climate? What was the emotional atmosphere in the context when the family became a family?
Yeah. And alongside all of those developmental markers as well. Sure. And as I've been doing that, the person who's influenced me a lot is one of my mentors, Dr. Patricia Crittenden. And so you and I have been reading the same book about this.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I'm glad I can actually read a book and finish a chapter. It's been a while. Yeah, so we're going to be talking about Dr. Crittenden's book. It is called Attachment and Family Therapy, by Patricia Crittenden, and co-authors include Rudy Dallos, Andrea Landini, and I hope I'm going to say this right, Kasia Kozlowska. I hope I got it right.
I believe so. She's from Australia. I think she's a psychiatrist who works with a lot of families in a psychiatric hospital.
Wow.
Okay. So, yeah, so as we've been reviewing their chapter on specifically infancy and what that does, like what the challenges are during infancy, and then also how this affects the family system, we just want to acknowledge that a lot of families begin with pregnancy or a birth, or there's some kind of a baby that comes into a home. And we want to just chat really specifically about that first year, that infancy time. Well, actually, let's talk about the whole time up until sort of toddlerhood.
Yeah, let's do it.
So this is a very massive transition for the family system. And of course, the family is going to be facing emotion like joy, but then also tremendous fear, right? Around pregnancy, around can we even get pregnant, around having that the big adjustment of an infant in the home, and then also loss, because there is a lot that changes. And so it's very much a period of heightened emotion and then a time of a heightened need for attachment.
Yeah, I just like what you said right there, just to kind of underscore that point, is there is loss because there is change to the system. The two are kind of inextricably linked.
Yeah, so actually one of Crittenden's quotes in the book is, she says, the joyful event that establishes new relationships puts stress on existing relationships. And she says, change does not come without cost. And so we really want to get curious with families about what this time was like. And actually, there's a lot of risk that can enter the family system at this time, because birth can actually bring death, right? Birth often brings complications. Birth can bring trauma. So there's a lot at stake. And we want to inquire around how the family managed this, because that's going to tell us a lot about the family's resources. But also, as we know, when distress comes into a system, that's when you see strategies showing up. So we can learn a lot from the family system around what their resources were, how they got through that. Did they get through it together? What were some limitations? And did symptoms start to pop up, you know, around this time specifically?
Yeah, I can just kind of see in my head, like, you know, like the links being made here, where there could be trauma, where there could be complication. Then we're going to see increased stress. We're going to see how people respond to stress because now they're in distress. Like, you can just see how boom, 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 before you know it. And then the strategies will become more evident. They're going to become more visible, I think.
I think so too. And I think that this is very typical of family life and family development, is one of the hardest things is that suddenly you have conflicting needs. Because you have more needs, right? Like, as families grow and you now have more attachment relationships, it's no longer just like the two of you as a couple managing your couple relationship. Now, suddenly, we've also got to learn to be parents together. And we've got to manage that parent-child bond. And what are you going to do if these two people that you love so much both have a need? Like, which one are you going to attend to first, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, I remember with my husband, like, Etienne and I were married for, gosh, like 12 years, I think, before we started having kids. And we were shocked at what a change it was. Like, we suddenly had to learn how to be parents together. And mm-hmm. suddenly there wasn't much time to be a couple. And that was a massive, that affected us in a really big way.
For sure. And honestly, like, how could it not? Like, you know, even as shocked as you can be, it's like there's a whole other heart, living, breathing, beating heart in the home. And
right.
this
right.
particular little beating heart has a lot of needs. There's a lot they can't do for themselves.
Oh gosh. And you hit the ground running, and definitely people try to tell you and you try to prepare. The problem is, though, that the change happens. And then suddenly you've got all this stuff to work out while you're exhausted and hormonal and trying to meet the needs, right, of this brand new baby as well, like you said.
Yeah.
So this concept of just conflicting needs and then having to manage, like, how do we juggle this, that often, I think, puts stress on a family system.
Yeah. Talk about having to think on the fly, right? Like, this is on the job training to become a parent. Like, when there's a conflicting need, urgent need right there in front of you. And you've never done this before, and you have to figure it out right there in the moment.
Right. So I think one of the typical things that happens in the family system, if you've got, you know, two or more parents, is that sort of either the non-birthing parent or the non-primary attachment parent can start feeling really left out. And certainly parents can parent together, but sometimes one of the parents takes a more primary attachment role with baby, and that really can shift the relationship of the other parent. That parent can even feel left out during the pregnancy. Things start to shift. And so you can see the genesis of couples distress if this person is a couple. Mm-hmm. And we want to ask questions about that and start asking, how did that person cope? Was the couple able to talk about this? Were they able to predict this? Because, of course, if this family does have older kiddos, that parent who's feeling a little left out can play a very important role in keeping the other kids busy holding the rest of the system, you know, stable while the one parent is consumed with baby, right? And can that other parent kind of normalize this, help the older siblings understand what needs to happen and why? Can they help the older siblings still have a positive view of this new baby that's creating so much change? Can they teach the older siblings how to be a little more self-sufficient, right? There's lots of jobs to be done still.
Yes, I'm just sitting here like there are so many jobs to be done. There are so many moving parts of the family to be attentive to that require attention, require care, require problem solving. And I'm just kind of thinking about, yeah, exactly how, if it is a two-parent family, how they figure out all those moving parts, how they manage all this change, and are they, you know, binary options, are they connected while they do that, or on the spectrum of connected to disconnected, like where are they at as a couple and as new parents as they manage all these moving parts? Because yeah, especially when you have siblings in the house, they got to get worked out too.
Right.
Grandparents, how do grandparents fold into this? Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Is there an extended family or support system to help out? How does that single parent manage this all by themselves?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And especially if the birth has been traumatic, and that parent is needing to take time to take care of themselves just physiologically. Yeah, there's just a lot to juggle. Mm-hmm. And so walking into that emotional and relational space with the parents in front of you years later gives you a chance to join that time a little bit and possibly even reprocess it, find out how that was, what's been dealt with, what hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right, what pain has gotten stuck or been carried forward from such an important time of starting a family. And then, of course, so that's a little bit of like what's happening in the larger family, you know, with the other parent, with potential siblings, with extended family. We also want to think about what's happening in the world at large, like what kind of a community context is this family a part of? Was there support? Was there additional stress? Was there loss of income, jobs, financial stress, some kind of discrimination for the kind of family that they are or the choices that they're making? You know, what world do they live in at the time, right? Was this happening during COVID and the other parent wasn't even allowed to be there during the birth?
Hmm.
Maybe. Right?
So many COVID stories. I've heard so many COVID stories.
Yeah.
That ecosystem, just as systemic therapists, you know, going beyond, you know, that home, that what was under that roof, right? Going beyond that. Yeah. I think about all the COVID stories I've heard and all the parents I worked with during COVID. And it's just traumatic, man. It was just rough. It was rough. Parents just trying to get through it. Especially while they had, you know, like older kids at home who were like being, you know, homeschooled, right? Like online school while they're trying to manage a new.
I know, right? So hard. I think especially the parents with teens could be the toughest, and then toddlers at home. Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we could do a whole thing on COVID, right?
Good.
As we're talking a little bit about just the bigger family system and thinking about siblings, I remember when we had our second child, that during pregnancy, I went through a little grieving time of saying goodbye to our kind of original family. We still call it the original three, my husband, myself, and then my son, because he got to be an only child for 12 months. Lucky little guy. He got all our attention, right? And he got more rested parents, although we were also exhausted. But we did all get to sleep at the same time. And I remember just thinking, wow, he's no longer going to be an only child when his little sister comes along. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the losses, right? A joy to have a larger family, but also a significant change to the three of us.
Yeah. That's interesting. My family has a similar kind of mindset about it. As we talk about, our family has had three families. So it was my parents, they married young and they were committed to not having kids right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I forget how many years into marriage they had my sister. And then my sister was an only kid for 6 years. And then my mom was like, okay, it's time to have some more kids. And my mom and dad decided they were expecting two. They wanted these two kids to be closer in age. And so, like, I was the most planned baby. They talk about how it was the couple, just my parents. Then it was my parents with my eldest sister. And then it was the couple of us all together, and how we've had three families within one.
Yeah, like three really distinct phases, right?
Yeah.
And as you're talking about, like, your parents' wishes for the last two sibs to be, like, really close in age and probably relationally, I think it's so, I felt like it was very important to think about trying to build the sibling bond very intentionally. Mm-hmm. And so I remember being pregnant and letting my son do finger painting of my belly and rubbing my belly and talking to little baby and really just trying to get him connected to his sister so they could start that relationship, and also so that when she came into the world, he wouldn't feel so threatened by her. Mm-hmm. So I remember when we went to the hospital to have her, the little baby gave him like a really big gift to unwrap at home that was exciting. And then I'd also been coached by some more experienced parents that when I was feeding her, that could be a time that he felt especially far away from me, because I wouldn't be able to be accessible physically. And so to have like a basket of toys that were kind of novel that I only brought out when I really couldn't attend to him because I was feeding her or working with her, so that that time could also be feel kind of more special to him.
Wow.
So, and then lastly, like talking to him a lot about, you're the big brother, you get to take care of her. Oh my gosh, you see how she's looking at you? She thinks you're amazing. But just really trying to work on them having a good association of each other, but particularly him, because he had to make a big adjustment again to suddenly having to have shared parental attention. You know, that's a big deal for him emotionally.
Yeah. Wow. Look at that. Look how intentional that is in nurturing and fostering that relationship between those two.
Yeah.
Very beautiful. What you did for them. I mean, that was a really beautiful thing, what you did for them.
Thank you. I was lucky to learn that actually through working with some families in years past where siblings had really gone through a trauma when the new child was born. And these are common things to hear about in our family work, is that symptoms started for an older sibling once baby came along. And sometimes that older sibling is just like the perfect only child. Like, they just never really wanted to have a younger or they were just so
really necessary.
yeah, exactly. And I mean, you get different personality types, right? And temperament types. And some just really like to have their own space and like to call the shots. They're very strong-willed kids. Mm-hmm. And then you have kids who are super connected to a parent. And so when their parent suddenly does become inaccessible because maybe they've got a harder to raise child or baby's born and has mm-hmm. some kind of sickness or disability, they really feel like they lose a parent. Mm-hmm. And then I think that they take it out on the sibling as opposed to actually the parent, right, who disappears. So
because if that loss isn't organized, right, if that loss doesn't get organized and doesn't get
right,
permission,
yeah, right?
We're going to see these strategies of how to cope with that distress from the sibling.
Yeah. And that's why we often join these families 9, 10, 15, or even years later, And we have to go back and understand, hold on, what's the history here around this relational injury? When did this begin? When were they close? When did things shift? Mm-hmm. And can we go back and organize that and understand it and have those conversations so that we can help with healing and rebalancing in the system?
Yeah, I mean, this is just making me think about one of the shifts in family therapy is siblings, adult siblings. Right? Adult siblings wanting to come back in and repair their relationship and go through that attachment history and what was the context of how did this relationship get formed and under what context or what emotional climate. It's one of the growing areas of family therapy that has already come knocking at my practice, right? It's my clinical door. It's already come for me.
Yeah.
So grateful that I have attachment science, and I have EFFT to make sense of and to figure out what to assess for, what to ask, to contextualize this relationship.
Right. Yeah, I think that could and should be another whole episode on just sibling relationships, period, right? But then, so we're talking a little bit about like what does the partner go through when a baby comes on the scene, what do the siblings go through? How's the, you know, maybe the birthing parent doing or the primary parent, if you have such a thing. And then I think we got to look a little bit at the actual infant and like, what are the needs that need to happen in this first and second year of life? Mm-hmm. And I think that parenting an infant is very specific. Like, we know that if a baby is born into this world and there's no one to look after it, that baby's going to die. Mm-hmm. And that feels so harsh to say, but it's true. Like, there's absolute dependency. And so parenting an infant is about just nurturing and keeping that baby alive, right? The parenting job is pretty specific. Keep that baby alive and then nurture the baby, because I think one of the big things that this book and Crittenden and her colleagues are talking about is that in those first couple weeks and over those first 2 years, what babies are learning to do is to regulate arousal. When babies have a need, and luckily those needs are pretty specific, we kind of know the baby has a needs a temperature change, is hungry, needs a diaper change, or maybe needs some comfort. The baby has a very clear signaling system, right, which is crying and maybe putting their arms out and waving around, but the baby's distress is usually kind of clear. Mm-hmm. And what needs to happen is that the baby needs a caregiver who sees the need, supplies the need, so that the baby's arousal system goes off. Mm-hmm. So baby has a need, arousal up, caregiver respond, arousal down. Mm-hmm. And so baby's constantly going between an aroused state and a calm state. And depending on how that happens over those first few weeks and the 2 years, mm-hmm. that then determines the baby's internal state of managing their arousal.
Okay, so you're saying that I'll call it an interaction, the interaction between baby's distress cry signal and caregiver responding, that interaction repeated thousands of times over the first weeks and 2 years, that interaction is going to impact the baby internally and is going to create like a mental model of how I'm going to get my needs met.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Like a mental model eventually once the baby has more brain capacity to understand this stuff. Mm-hmm. But it is already creating a physiological model.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Right before the mental model's even there, it is creating a physiological model that affects literally your neural pathways.
Okay.
And also the ability of like the vagal system, the vagal break, to turn off the parasympathetic nervous system or turn it on and to make it like easier language, fight, flight.
There we go.
Right. When do I need to go into fight, flight, freeze, fawn in order to get my needs met? And then when do I need to turn that off? Because imagine if you're constantly in fight, flight, freeze, fawn state. I mean, your body would be exhausted.
Yeah.
And depleted. And then that would affect your overall development.
Right.
Including brain development, language development, maybe physical development, etc.
Yeah. Because those are all states of stress, states of cortisol.
Right.
So then the caregiver response brings all those cortisol and adrenaline down. And then baby regulates internally. And then we're going to do that dance thousands of times. And baby is going to, you're saying, depending on how that gets responded to,
then that all becomes internalized eventually.
Right.
And I don't know, as we're just talking about this dance of attachment and regulating the child's internal arousal and distress, it does feel overwhelming, right? It feels like it's a lot for a caregiver to be responsible for. Like, I feel kind of overwhelmed as we're talking about this.
Whew. Like the responsibility of it all.
Right. And it's like if maybe all the caregiver got to do was just respond to baby, right? If the world could just stand still and you were just in a silo. You know what? I mean, I remember with my third child, I've got three kids, and with the third one, I actually traveled from America to South Africa on a 24-hour flight door-to-door. And she was six weeks old, and I was actually going to teach couples therapy in Cape Town, South Africa. And I was exhausted, obviously. And I was also teaching like a 4-day course for the first time, new material. And I did have a support system around me. So I had my little sister come and help. My little sister's job, I think, was to help with all the people and the registrations and the event. I did have like a nanny come who was going to help me with Colette. Mm-hmm. And we all stayed in a little home together. But during that time, I remember that I was really stressed and I wasn't sleeping well and my body was just stressed. And there was a day where I was still breastfeeding and I was feeding Colette and she wouldn't drink. Mm. And it was going hours and hours and hours with her not drinking. And she was a pretty healthy, really big baby. And so I started freaking out because this baby wasn't drinking. And then one afternoon, I said to my sister, oh my gosh, let's get in the car and go to the hospital. There's something wrong with this baby. And we got in the car and we started going. And we got there and I sat in the car and I tried to feed her again. And then she drank. And then in that moment, I thought to myself, I'm so stressed out. Like my muscles are tight. I'm anxious. I haven't slept. I wonder if she's picking up all this distress and it's freaking her little system out and she's not interested in drinking right now. I think that's what it was. That's what it was. Like when I look back, you know.
Thank you for sharing this story. And you're saying like if all we had to do was tend to baby and the interaction and the attunement and the attachment process. Wow, that'd be a lot easier. And that's not how it happens. But life keeps happening. Family life keeps happening. Obligations keep happening.
Right.
So we're trying to juggle all of these conflicting needs during this time. And how interesting how it sounds like when you got in the car and got away from the training and got some distance, that's something maybe relief of just knowing you were on your way to a hospital.
Right. Like I could maybe do something, help do
something different and
maybe
yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. Got me to relax a little bit.
That's tough.
So I think like some of the variables are that babies are born. Obviously there's some nature, which is like some babies are just a bit easier to regulate their arousal than others. Like, I think there are individual differences in how intense their arousal gets. But the moment that baby's born, you've also got nature starting to play a role. And so right away, there's this dance that starts to happen, this joint input between the way that the baby is made and then the way that the caregiver comes to the table. So immediately there's a joint dance that starts between baby and parent. Mm-hmm. Actually, it reminds me of Winnicott, one of the attachment researchers, said there's no such thing as a baby. There's no such thing as a mom. This was way back when he said these words. He said there's only a nursing pair. Like, you don't exist apart from each other, because the baby can't live by itself, right? So there's a pair. There's just a pair, and they exist together. Pair.
We just begin as a dyad.
Yeah, there's this dyad, right? And then, you know, the child development people do say that it takes like the first 3 years, and over time you start to, like, it takes 10 months before the baby even knows that it's something separate. There's object permanence. And then by 3, the baby fully individually understands that they're like a separate person, right? It takes years for that to build. But back to this, like, attachment and arousal piece, is that there is this joint input right away, with nature and nurture both playing a role. And so what can happen is that a parent, let's say in a perfect world, baby has arousal, parent responds, distress stops. That happens millions of times. And then eventually baby internalizes that and knows how to self-soothe. Another pattern that can happen, though, is that a parent is too responsive. Like, let's say a parent responded perfectly the whole time. What about even just kept baby on their chest permanently so that baby never got hyper-aroused? What happens is that the child would then never learn how to regulate themselves, because they're never in a place where they have to practice.
Right.
So actually, right, the rupture, repair, a decent amount of arousal is important for learning. And then on the other side, let's say there's not much responsiveness when baby's aroused, or that responsiveness takes way too long, or is so intermittent that it's hard for the baby to predict.
Mm-hmm.
The baby won't learn the contingencies. The baby won't learn, here's how aroused I need to be, or here's how you get someone to respond. Here's how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on a worst case scenario, the baby might not know at all and might think high intense arousal is just part of life. And who knows how on earth to make that better? Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but the baby has like no sense. Because the baby could never quite recognize a sequence, right? And so there's like no prediction on how to do this dyadic thing.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by this whole, I guess it's a process, right? It's a process repeated a lot of times over the course of those first couple of years. And it's just amazing to me how reading from the book, there's this somatic mapping that happens, like what kind of body distress does this baby need to show to get the response from the caregiver, which right. leads into yeah. like the mental model eventually of this is a contingency, this is how it works with this caregiver. It's mm-hmm. just amazing to me how mm-hmm. this is all happening. Like,
it's alarming. Like, it's such a big, important thing, but how many of us really get taught that this is what's happening and this is so important? Right. It's like this unseen attachment dance. Mm-hmm. But if you look back into the history, if it's probably not going well, you might look back and see that it affected brain maturation. It affects the baby's ability to discriminate emotional expression and faces. It affects their social skills. It affects them physiologically, and they can end up with feeding difficulties. Or you can look back in the history and see, oh, baby was pretty calm. Baby could pay attention. Baby could play. Baby ate fine. Baby could exercise. There was a moderate level of distress, right? Like, there is a way to look back. And there's some telltale signs of maybe how this attachment went.
Ugh. I just think it's amazing. And my brain is going to, like, as a clinician, what would I be looking for?
Yeah.
And that may not be where we want to go right now with the time that we have left. But I just think it's when you think about it and you think about what baby does, caregiver responds, the timing of the caregiver response to be able to create a contingency pattern or not. Is it predictable? Is the response predictable? Is the response intermittent? Is the response timely? Is it not? And how baby and caregiver are doing this dance so that for the goal of regulating arousal.
Yeah. It's heavy. And yet this early attachment really does affect the child individually in terms of how they manage arousal and regulation. And the whole family system is affected. And I think it just, again, underscores for me, like, what a massive event this is. Mm. The time of infancy in the life of a family. And I hope that this, I know that for me, kind of studying this a bit and reading this book has helped me think about that time differently and help me come up with various assessment questions and an idea of what to listen for and to feel into for that time of the family life. And I hope it's helpful to our listeners. And it would be fun, Rhonda, to kind of do this on every developmental stage.
I agree. I'm ready for it. Let's do it. We'll tackle toddlerhood next.
Yeah, sounds great.
Well, listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. We had a bit of a different show for you today. It's going to be the first of a series as Catherine and I talk about the book Attachment and Family Therapy by Crittenden and co-authors. So stay tuned as we bring you the next installments of this series. And again, thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us. And we hope you're getting some good nuggets for your family therapy work. Thanks. Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, Rhonda. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao. Bye.
That's it for today, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again for our next journey.